Detta är kassett nummer 2, det är sida nummer 1. Det är fortsättning på intervju med Jan Werner i Cranston, Rhode Island. Och det är den 21 augusti 1985. Så
det kan jag beskriva något som en båt som ges på den floden och varför det måste ha så lätt maskineri för att floderna var inte mycket vatten.
Nej, grunda, ja.
Båten i sig själv var 148 fot lång och 58 fot bred. Men den kunde inte ha mycket drag. Vad heter det på svenska?
Ja, alltså... ja, vad heter det?
Vad draft heter
det? Ja, draft. Jag draft på engelska. Det är alltså... dräktighet, eller vad kallas det?
Ja, på svenska kan jag inte säga vad det
ja.
På engelska heter det draft.
Draft, ja.
Ja. Som en stor båt.
Det är för att det var så shallow water.
En stor båt som går på Atlanten kan dra kanske en 25, 30 och 35 fot.
Ja, men så de här båtarna nu, de sköt andra pråmar framför sig? Eller hade de last också?
De hade last, ja.
De hade last.
Bolaget fraktade spannmål och så vidare ifrån tidvatten upp.
Aha.
Ungefär 400 mil ifrån saltvatten upp till Macon, Georgia, var vi var. Men jag säger båten, som man säger, 148 lång.
Och 58 bred.
18 tum vatten, alltså drog.
18 tum?
18 tum. 18 inches.
Det var inte mycket det.
Nej, det måste vara så byggt på det. Det var så grunt.
Ja, jag kan se det.
Det måste vara lätt maskineri och allting måste vara lätt på den. Så.
Jaha.
Ja. Så det var en ovanlig båt.
Det var så, ja. Ja, det var jag.
Det var särskilt byggd och särskilt
ja, det var specialgrejer alltihop,
ja.
Som gjorde att
jag kom dit, så var det någon ingenjör, båtbyggeri, nästan samma ålder som jag var. För jag var då, tänker jag, en 1916. Ja. Jag var 20. 8 år.
28 år. Fortfarande ogift då? Du var inte gift då?
Nej, nej.
He?
Nej, nej. Nej, nej. Och så att efter provköring först insåg jag att det var inte nog kraft till mota strömmen. Så. Så att vi skulle få en mera likadant ångpanna och maskin. Maskineri utan ångpanna var det var bra, ja. Men inte nog ånga.
Inte nog ånga?
Nej. Så att, och då fick de lov ute till att de skulle på den i 6 veckor.
Ja.
Och det här var på tidigt på båden, inte långt efter nyåret, jag är ju ditt del. Och då så, jag fick lov på det 6 veckor, så den som var president för bolaget som hade båten hade ändrat om denna, hade gjort fel, så han out och fick en annan och sa, stannar du här i 6 veckor, allt är betalt som du kom hit för och du får bo på hotellet och mat och allting där. Bara stanna. Ja. 8 månader.
8 månader.
8 månader var jag där och vänta. Vi hade börjat kriget och han lovade på 6 veckor, men han kunde inte få material och så vidare. Och det gick.
Vad gjorde du under 8 månader?
Vad kunde jag göra? Jag gick ner till lokalen var inte någonting ner och de hade besättning på båten, allting som höll tillsammans skulle vara när den var färdig.
Åtta månader
var nog september tror jag, och dit ner inte så väldigt långt efter nyår.
Så det var en lång väntetid. Hur gick det nu då?
Ja, efter de fick landmaskineriet var det starkt nog till att gå.
Asså? Ja. Så det blev förbättringar.
Och då gick jag bak till New York igen.
Till New York igen, ja. Så när kom du tillbaka nu då till ifrån New York till Cranston?
Ja, det var jag var borta där ifrån när jag fick slut och inte hade arbete på fabriken. Det var nog en annan pojk med en alldeles som heter Blomqvist, Benny Blomqvist. Han arbetade också och han blev avlagd på samma gång. Så vi gick tillsammans och gick ner till var båtar kom in i Providence. En lokal var sjömän samlas ganska mycket och vi gick dit mer för nyfiken eller något annat, Benny Blomqvist och jag. Och då var det någon som kom upp ifrån Newport som ville ha fyra unga personer till besättningen som de hade på en jakt, sjögående jakt, en ovanlig, det var stora, på den tiden hade de rika som Vanderbilt och Astor och alla, de hade stora lyx båtar. Väldigt stor omsättning egentligen, men det var de rikaste i Newporten de hade. Så jag fick, det var en first mate som ville ha fyra. Och Benny sa, går du så går jag. Jag sa, okej, jag ska gå, jag går. Jag var 16 och ett halvt år då. Det var 1905. Nej, det var 1907.
Ja, det vill säga, 1907.
Ja, 1907. Då var jag 16 och en halv år. Stämmer det?
Ja, 1888, det är 12. Ja, 5.
Ja, 1907. Ja, jag var 16 och en halv år. Så att vi stämde möte, vi skulle vara dit bak klockan 4. Och jag gick hem och sa till mamma, jag har hyttmarsch upp på en båt. Du får inte gå någon, du får säga till pappa. Jag säger, jag sa till mannen att jag ska bara dit ska fyra. Jag kan inte göra något annat. Jag.
Hon tyckte inte om båtar. Hon tyckte inte om båtar.
Ja. Så jag får lite underkläder och så vidare. Så satte till sig jag. Och Benny, han hade inte gått för sina föräldrar. Han fick inte gå.
Han fick inte gå?
Så jag är ensam.
Så han fick inte.
Men det var två till därifrån, som på båten. Och det var en som man säger, en lyx båt för båten heter Apache och det var för den som var framför New York Yacht Club, kommandör för Yacht Club, så att båten var nummer en båt, alla de stora som hörde till det rika där nere. Den största båten var 350 fot lång, som hörde till Morgan, J.P. Morgan. De var 350 fot långa och olika. Sådana stora båtar hade de. De rikade sig. Oj, oj, oj.
Så vad blir ditt arbete nu?
Ja, en lärpark i sköta om. Den båten hade vad de kallar för full med järland.
Ja.
Seglar. Du järland säger så.
Ja, 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 just det. Ja.
De två första masterna hade fem järlams så ja. På var och så hade en stor segel och andra. Och det vi sköt om och sköt om seglar och klättra upp
ja.
Till det här. Men ja. jag fick inte gå högre än nummer ett. Den första. Nej, det måste vara mellan
som erfarna ja.
Ja, som säkra på så för den högsta där uppe det var fem som var sådana järlands. Och det var ju så de kunde få ett tåg hålla för seglar måste dras upp och kastas upp och bindas över järlands och det är väldigt de måste veta vad de gjorde så ja. Det måste dras upp och kastas upp på själva där och gjorde inte, om det inte måste heller vänta att det kom inte till ankar. Ja.
Ja. Hur långa resor gjorde de båtarna ut i?
Jag skulle gå till England, men det blev sån storm. Så vi måste ta in Azores, är ju några öar som är till Portugal. Ja. Lite i vägen mer söder om än England. Där var så långt vi gick bak igen.
Och tillbaka igen?
Det skulle ha varit en kappkörning mellan de stora båtar.
Ja. Och du var med över på en sån resa?
Ha?
Och du var med på en sån resa över då?
Just det. Men när vi kom bak sedan till Nyport så slutade jag upp med det. Det var lite för svårt.
Lite för mycket, ja.
Fyra timmar måste arbeta och fyra timmar sömn. Men hur mycket tid har man då man skulle äta in emellan och så vidare? Inte något, det var för mycket.
Ja. Nej.
Och så var det inte så vidare bra, bekvämt heller, så att jag slutade upp.
Du slutade upp. Men sen, när du kom tillbaka nu från New York, du var 28 år gammal då, ja. Vad gammal var du när du gifte dig?
Nu talar jag nu, har du varit i Macon, Georgia?
Ja, Macon, Georgia, ja.
Väl, då arbetet... Bolaget som jag var med hade en plats var det en verkstad var de byggde sina saker och dit kom jag och det var uppe i norra delen utav New York staten nära Kanada-gränsen nära man säger, i New York stat och dit var jag då.
Vad heter den platsen?
Ja, det var verkligen inte någon stad där. Mera åt gränsen till Kanada. Ja. Jag tror det kunde heta Wachasia någon, men det var en fabrik utom ganska långt om något. Jag har byggt automobiler där någon gång. Så, mm-hmm. Ja.
Och hur länge höll du på där?
Ja.
Hur länge?
Väl... kriget hade börjat ut under tiden. Så, ja. Så att... jag gick då fick arbete på bolaget hette Standard Oil New York. Standard Oil New York, båten. Jag hade många tankar. Ja.
Så den arbetade du på då?
Ja, då var jag där så länge kriget var där. Och sedan så efteråt gick jag till en utav den som hade mig anställd i första början, hade gått bak till staten Washington och i Seattle. Och han ville att jag skulle dit. Han var uppfinnare och han hade en idé om en ny maskin som skulle gagna både ånga och gasolin. Expositionen i driv som det gör när explosion byggt upp tryck med en fjäder som öppnas upp och då är det en annan cylinder. Och där möttes den av vatten som sprutade upp allting tillsammans som där gick dit, så mötte det vatten och det var själva drivsatsen där hälften
unga.
Det var välja hälften steam och hälften
bensin.
Ja, just vad man kallar sig.
Fungerade det då?
Ha?
Fungerade?
Ja, jag var hos honom ett helt år.
Ett helt år?
Ja, han försökte, men han ser hela tiden med en gasolin engine är ju att de måste kyla av det. Det har mycket kraft, kan inte begagna det. Det måste kylas av med en radiator och Anna går ut. Man tror att sig the man, otherwise that I worked for, he had patents in 23 different countries, for all the countries that had patent laws at that time when he took them out, in 23 different countries. They were all inventors, and I can't invent a thing. Not even a lie, I try sometimes, but they kept me at it.
So you worked with this guy then for a whole year?
Yeah, I was a whole year.
What were you doing then? You
I was working with him on the engine, getting the engine ready.
And you built it from scrap?
Huh?
You built the whole engine from scrap then?
I worked with him all the time.
Yeah. How big of an engine was it?
Well, it was just an ordinary four-cylinder engine. I forget what make it was, one of the standard automobile engines at that time. That was 1919, see.
1919.
When I spent the whole year in Seattle.
Oh, so he was well to do then?
Huh?
This guy was well to do then?
He had some patents that he got royalty on. See, that's what he lived on.
So there?
Yeah. It's, he was an inventor. He was quick. When they first developed heavier than air power for airplanes, they even looked into steam, you know, see, because there was some steam automobiles, two or three different makes. So they made them light, and they were interested in if they could make light enough. So instead of gas, they could use steam. Some promoter, you know how they are to promoter things. They write up a lot of things to try to sell stock on it, see. And I don't think it was a legitimate thing, but there was a lot of brochures on it and everything. And they paid them $1,000 a week just to draw up the particulars of it, see. Yeah. And that's the kind of work he could do. He was very smart.
But it didn't fly.
Huh?
It didn't fly.
Yeah.
It didn't fly.
No, they never took any steam, no.
No.
Not as far as I know. They could have got some off the ground, maybe, I don't know. But never, no. Heavier than air was something they worked at. They had lighter than air.
Oh.
Well, the Hindenburg was
the helium gas.
Yeah, I say it was not heavier than air. they had to get a very light internal combustion engine for that.
So what happened then after a year when you have worked a year? Did he say that he had to stop or no more money, or how did it end your contract with him, your work with this guy now? How did you quit?
With Paul Mulligan?
Yeah.
Well, two other fellows and I formed a little corporation, and we went from Seattle to New York. Oh. And we put in $2,000 a piece, I guess, and we had some things from the West Coast. The West Coast had some things ahead of the East Coast in development on automobile engines, automobile for that matter.
See? At that time?
And so we had some things from there that we took us to the East, to New York, and to sell. Mm. Merton Potter was the older one, and I forget what the other one was. I'll come to me in a minute. We came here. I came first in January 1920 and found room for them, for one thing, see. And when they came, I hired $20 a week. That was a lot of money in them days, you know, see. He said, what are you get moving into the court of St. James? We don't need that. But I couldn't get anything suitable. They were fairly well fixed, I think. So I know they could pay it. So anyway, came in January. I came first, and then they came. They stayed on to August. During that time, Merton Potter went by train to Seattle twice, and each time he stayed a couple of weeks there. He didn't have much time to do any work, did he? And the other younger fellow, he went one time to Seattle. And by the time the money ran out, their money had run out, but I had made enough in commissions. The young fellow and I, we were on commission on what we sold, see. And I had made enough so that I hadn't paid in my 2,000, see. I said, you get it when we come east. So I think I had... out of 2,000, I think I had 600 more owed. The others I made up in commission over and above what the other fellow sold for. So I went home and got $600 from my father and squared up. And then they went back to Seattle. But we had a typewriter and desk and a few things in the office there, see? And it says, how much? I said, $350. Everything is in here. We had no merchandise stock, not much anyway, very little, see. Okay, that's the same. I was in business.
By yourself then?
Huh?
By yourself?
Oh yes. And I stayed out in New York then from this was in August of 1920 that they went back. And I stayed out until the fall of 1922, and I was in business. Uh-huh. And then I said, well, I was doing fairly well. And I thought if I could make it in New York with all the competition, I was footwork around all the automobile service stations and garages and things like that, see. And I formed some acquaintances there, one thing, and then I learned a lot of things. And I said, if I can make it with a competition in New York, I can make it home. So I went home and established a small company. Started with nothing, really.
Here in...
In Providence.
In Providence.
Yeah, right in Providence.
So your business now in New York, was this to sell to automotive stores then, or...?
Selling to garages and service stations.
Tools?
Yeah, mostly mechanical things.
Oh, mechanical things.
Yeah,
I see.
Tools.
So the competition in New York was hard? There was a lot of competition in New York?
Oh, there was a lot of... salesmen of that type calling on them, you know. So it was started at the turn when the automobile supplies and things were coming in, building more and more automobiles. See, and I thought it was a good chance to go into that. Oh. I had no experience really, only what I got in New York, But that was a very good experience, and I started with...
But here now you had a degree in engineering.
Yes.
Marine engineering.
Yes.
Wasn't that too good of a degree to... you didn't need that degree to sell automotive parts, though.
No,
why didn't you go into the merchant marines, for instance, to be an engineer and you got good pay?
No.
You were not interested in that?
I had been then to sea for about away for about 17 years almost.
And that was enough?
I didn't want any more.
I didn't want any more.
My people were here, my father and mother was here, my sister and my brother were here. I got a picture of them.
Yeah. So you wanted to come back then to settle here?
And I wanted to settle down.
So 1922 then, you came back to Providence?
In the fall. The same year that my wife came from Sweden. I met her in the fall of 1922. She'd only been here a couple of weeks. To his sister, he had two sisters here in Providence.
Oh, I see.
But we didn't get married until about 16, 17 years later.
Oh, I see.
We were married in 1940. See? And this was in 19...
You mean you went steady for so many years?
No. We parted, and she says, no matter where I am, I'll keep in touch with my sister. In fact, I'll be going to Providence frequently, which she did. And she called me up, and she says, anytime we can get together again, I'll be back.
Huh? And her name was...
Lily.
Lily.
L-I-L-Y. Lily.
Lily, yeah. And her last name?
Her last name was Holm.
Holm. And she came from Östergötland?
Yep, she did.
Oh. Where in Östergötland?
Linköping. Suburbs of Linköping.
Oh.
Yeah. I know the family. We went to Sweden 7 times, and each time we visited mostly with her people.
So you started the business then in Providence?
Yeah, it really started in 1923.
Oh, did you rent the place then, or did you buy a place? Or
No. I rented it.
Rented?
Yeah.
A garage?
I started it more or less on a shoestring, we'll put it that way, because I didn't get much money in Seattle, see, working on these internal combustion steam engine, he called it. His income was just so much, and he had to pay me enough to live anyway, and so I came away from there with not too much.
But did you learn anything from that experience in Seattle? Did you learn anything for a whole year there?
No, listen, I was not interested in inventing. I see so much of it between the other engineer and Mulligan. There was no money in it. Even Talbot had the patent in 23 different countries. On his stuff, see, and Mulligan had patents on a lot of things. That's how he got income from, for that matter, see. I think he invented some of the signal from the bridge to the engine room. He had some patents on that.
So you started then in Providence with a small beginning there?
I started with a shoestring.
You started to buy then, did you sell wholesale or retail, or how did you?
No, I made up my mind. If you could go in, I would go in wholesale, because I could get out of business quick there by selling off my stock, see, if something didn't go good. I had the margin between wholesale and retail. I could sell retail because I bought it wholesale, see.
Huh?
I mean, there's quite a step in between the jobber and the retail. It was then. Now it is not so much.
Huh?
That's the reason that Aina now started the Tristar Automotive Warehouse. Because the jobbing was getting too much, everybody going in the jobbing business, and the jobbers had to buy from a warehouse, so we launched a warehouse on just enough money in there to get the stationery, order forms and everything. In fact, we put $1,500 each in there.
I see.
I don't know whether Aina told you all of this.
So you had a partner in?
Huh?
You had a partner in? Did you start on your own, or did you have a partner when you started?
No, alone.
You were alone?
Oh, yeah.
You were single then, starting a business?
Yeah. Aina come to me when he was 17 years old.
1930.
Well, there could have been in the last days of 1929. That's when they had the big crash here, you remember?
Yeah. We are coming to that later on. So, how was the business then? How long did it take for you to... to get more and more, so you could see it was running smoothly.
Well, when you start small like that, it's tough to break in, really. And I started off by having a machine that I go around. In them days, did a lot of reboring and regrinding of cylinders, because metal in the end of them, they were soft, and some of them they get lopsided, so that they used a lot of oil. And because I think the metal that they're made out of was softer. Now they don't, at that time they get out.
Detta kassett 2, det är sida nummer 2, det är fortsättning på intervju med Jan Werner, Cranston, Rhode Island, och det är 21 augusti 1985. So you could actually take this machine and around to different places and
and get them
get the motors in there.
And then on account of reboring and making bigger, they had to have oversized piston rings.
Yeah.
See? And oversized pistons too, for that matter. Uh-huh. Both of them, see. So I stock up with oversized pistons and oversized piston rings, and I had sales automatically that way, see. Uh-huh. And then, of course, they also have a gasket, so one thing or another.
And they all added up. And you did the whole job yourself?
I did for at least 5 years. And then I got someone to come in. By that time, I accumulated stock. Gaskets and piston rings and bearings and this mostly engine parts, see. So I had someone to take telephone calls and also have the merchandise, which was not a lot of stock. No. Just certain lines, that was all.
And the one they bought from you were the garages and another.
Yeah. When I first started out, it's not easy to start. You're breaking into something that already is pretty established company, see. So you have to do something that they don't do. And I started in that way by servicing and doing mechanical jobs, which I had learned pretty much from Mulligan on the engines we worked on, one thing or another, so that I felt that was the best way to start. But I got all the names of the Swedish people, see, and I went to them first.
I see.
There was Pearson Brothers and Hendrickson and Hidman, a lot of those Swedes, and got acquainted with them, and some I probably knew from, not knew them in a business way, but might have known the Pearson Brothers. I think I knew the three of them. And I started in by talking them into letting me do that kind of work that I could do, see. Uh-huh. And I started in a small way. Uh-huh. And when Ana came to me in 1930, and then I had a fairly good stock of fast-moving items, like gaskets is one thing that they all turn in, and I have, and pistons and piston rings and bearings and all that stuff, see. There's another thing there that I don't think I want to get into, because it'll be too long a story.
What is that?
Well,
give me a little shot at it.
Well, when you get a bearing that heats up, you know, it's because of high spots in there. See, all right, there was no way they could grind that, because any metal that will grind it will embed itself in the soft metal. See? Mm-hmm. So, there were some companies that had made it, but a man came to me. I didn't know anything too much about anybody else, but a man came to me and said, I have something that will grind soft metal and would embed. See? And I said, that sounds very interesting, because I was interested. I had been there with Mulligan and so much through service station and garages that I knew that sounded good to me. You have? So he demonstrated to me, see. Well, it so happened there were other companies making. I was not the first one by a long shot. I think there was five in all. But I said, there was no one in the area here that I know of. So I said, what's the formula? And he says, it costs you $200 if you want it. And I says, okay, you demonstrate it to me, and that's what you say, $200 is cheap. So it did.
It did work?
Yeah. So I bought the formula, and I started making it. Do you know anything about mechanics?
Well, not in detail, but I know roughly though about the...
Well, in a general way, I'll tell you how that acted. You know what a case-hardened thing is?
Yes.
That's just case-hardened the outside of it, see?
Yeah.
All right. There was a certain mineral, it came from Mexico, well, I got anyway, see, that if you mix it up according to the formula, see, it would pop like popcorn, and it's minute particles, you can't see them, but they still had some edges on there, case hardened, see, and you could put that in and grind it for a while, and it would break down. It would only use up the sharpness of it, see, for a little while. I got myself a real connecting rod.
Yeah.
Because it was a real connector was hinged. The only connecting rod was that, you flop it over and tighten up, and that was the rod. You can open it up. So the only one, I got that. So they got a little arbor to demonstrate. Yeah. And I went on the road. For 25 weeks, I was away from home.
Doing this
12 weeks at one clip and 13 weeks at another time. I covered every city of any site between here and Mississippi River.
So, did you have a truck then? You had all the tools with you and everything?
There were no tools. All I needed was that rod and an arbor.
It was all
something to gouge it out a little bit. That was shorter to the high spot with a scraper a little bit. See?
And it worked.
Yeah, and shorter to, and you see it now. And you blew it up, you see, and you show, and it'll show up the high spots, and then I put the powder on. I was making it now, I understand, making the powder.
Yeah.
And that a little oil, clamp it up. You could hear grinding. You can hear grinding. See. And open it up again, and we brew it again, almost a perfect surface. I had a letter from the War Department, the United States, on War Department stationery. It had been a suction dredge. Name of it was Colonel Mitchie. It was out, long out, dredging out a channel, suction. You know, they had 20-inch bearings. On the main engine, the engine of the suction has got to be a powerful engine, and it was running hot.
Yeah.
And they would have had to go in quite a few hundred miles to a shop to have it open up and scrape out the high spots. See. And they put two cans of that stuff in there, right on the job, cooled it off, and they sent me a letter to that effect.
So you were sending out the formula yourself then? I mean this
power? I got a partner. I advertised New York Times for a partner.
Oh, I see.
They had to pay so much, someone to send it out if I was on the road and send in the orders, he could fill it and so on, see.
So you were in business then?
I was in that part of business, see.
How could you get the... the material now? You got that from Mexico, you said?
Yeah,
it came
in 400-pound barrels.
For heaven's sake.
Yeah.
So you used quite a bit then of it, I mean, when you were working?
Well, you had to buy it that way, that's the whole thing of it, see. It was a small operation in a way. But
it worked?
Oh, yes, I...
You never failed?
The first fall, I think, I went by train, I think, on train, see, I think that was in the fall and onto the spring, and then a second after I got back, the second trip I went out was for 13 weeks, I think. Then I had my own little runabout car, and I it was more a summertime job, see. Started in the spring and was out in the summer.
Oh, Who was running the shop here at home then, in Providence, when you were on the road?
Well, I tell you, this is a story. I had it made in the basement in New York. When I made it in New York, you see, for at least a year.
So you bought small cans then. How much could they buy then when you sold it? You bought it for one job only. You didn't sell it in gallon.
No. Only 2 ounce cans.
Oh, 2 ounce cans.
It was very light for that matter.
And you put the labels on and everything.
Oh, well.
And your name and address there. And
I'll tell you what I did. I sent out 100,000 circulars.
100,000.
Seven mailbags full of circulars. You can buy a listing of garages and service stations, see? And I got a listing of all of each of the Mississippi, and I mailed it out. 100,000 circulars, took seven mailbags to fill it up, to send it out.
How could you get money for the mailing? I mean, how could you get money for all this advertising?
Money?
Yeah.
Well,
it costs money to 100,000 circulars to print them and mail them out. And
well, that's another story. Two Texas millionaires wanted. If I get into this thing, there's be no end to what I'm telling you.
You had a good air then all over. I mean, two Texas millionaires.
Huh?
Two Texas millionaires. They backed you up.
Well, they wanted crack oil, oil cracking procedure. If you know, crude oil comes with a very heavy asphalt-based oil.
Yes.
They got lakes and lakes of it in Venezuela for one place. They can't use it because they have to heat it up for it to flow, see, it's so thick. But if they could crack that oil so that it gets fluent to flow.
Then you can pump it up.
Something to do with. Then they could use it. Then it becomes like Pennsylvania crude light, like that, see. And they would go to any extreme to spend money to do it. Well, this particular, if you want to call it a boiler or whatever you want to call it, steam making apparatus anyway, we had where the water came in from the top and went through a series of tubes and came out. You could test it with a little test valve, see, but you that had a regulator tube. If it got too hot, the regulator tube would shut off to give it more water, and if it was too sloppy wet, then it would less water and more heat. Well, you could control the heat very much, but you could control the water coming in, less, more or less. The regulator tube took care of that, see. It's quite that was the inventor of the original one, the company that I went to, see. What were we talking about? To crack the oil, see. Yeah. These two Texas millionaires were determined they're going to find some way to crack that oil so it would flow like the other, see. They engaged a place in New Jersey, Worthington Pump Works. In my mind, I got all clear just what happened. And they wanted to buy one of our steam making boiler, you could call it, boiler, see. If they could get somebody to run it. And Talbot says, no man am I going to do that. He said, there's going to be gas in there, and we used to blow a tube once in a while. It was a tube like that, and another tube inside of it. It went to the end and came back in a small one. It was quite an invention. He had, I told you, in 23 different countries, he had patents on it. So anyway, so he says, no man must go. He says, if you blow a tube in there with the gas in there, the whole thing will go. He says, it'll go through the roof of the building here. He said, haven't you got a man that'll do it? He said, no man of mine's going to do it. But they offered me so much money that I couldn't refuse. And they took up insurance on me besides. I knew what danger there was, but I also knew that chances were not too great in a tube would blow, see. No. Because I had been to a Westinghouse plant in Pittsburgh where they claimed that they got too much tube failure, and the tube would blow, see. We meant they had to shut it down and put a tube in, see. And I sat there for 3 days watching that, nothing happened. So I knew the chances were pretty good. So I couldn't refuse the money when they offered me that. So I says, okay. So the
how much did they offer you?
Huh?
How much did they offer you?
Well, besides insurance on my life, $100 an hour.
$100 an hour?
Yeah.
And that was back in 19...
That was 19... Let me think now. This was before I went to Georgia. I would say it was in 1915.
So there was a risky job then. There was a high pay.
Well, I'll tell you what they did. they had to have two pumps. First with water. One pump, water. So you had to start with water. Then they had another pump. This is a high pressure pump because it was in there 250 pounds. That's quite a big pressure. See, they had very, very substantial pumps of that kind. So they had one pump of each, one for the water. And when I give them the signal that they could shift it over from the water to the oil, they would close one and open up the other one, and the oil would be flowing. In the meantime, they had a tank car come in on a railroad track alongside there with the crude oil, with the heavy oil, and another railroad track on the other side, after it go through the boiler, made into gas to condense it again. And then it flowed from there into another tank car, the new oil, see. You can see the expense they went to, see.
Right.
The fellows that run the pumps, they put up steel shields in front, shields. They said, no, I'm not going to be out in the open there. So they had steel shields for each one when they valve. And there I was all by myself. It was crazy, the whole thing. But anyway, it worked out fine.
You did?
Yeah, it worked fine. But what they done, they had plans, and well, they wanted me to come with them. But it was someplace in Louisiana, I think. And I looked it up on the map. They were building ships too, so there were these wooden ships. Talking about wooden ships, that's what Mulligan figured, that after the war was over, you see, they couldn't use these wooden ships because they had big Scotch boilers, these big round ones like that, see. And after the war was over, there was too much space giving up to boilers, and mostly boilers. So he figured that if these little units that he figured on, gas steam business, he could put them on shelves out there in the engine room, do away with the boiler completely, and have these little units there to run the engine with, see. No boiler room, see. Everything was all figured out, if it worked out, see. That's the whole thing of it, see. So we started the test there, and I was in front there, and I was testing it. So when I saw that steam was coming, I give them the signal, turn it on to the oil business, and they all started to go through there. And it worked out beautifully. It
did.
Really did, yeah. I had a little test valve on the side of it, see. And I would test it, and it came out a beautiful gas. And then in turn went into big condensers. In other words, a big trough with the cold water in there. And the gas flowed into there and condensed back to oil again, see.
Yeah. Oh, so you cracked the case then?
Well, they're the one that furnished the money.
So did they buy stock in your company then, or did they?
No, they paid Talbot so much.
Well, they
just bought the unit.
Bought the unit. Yeah.
That's all he wanted to sell.
Oh, but did they help you out later on then when you sent out 100,000 mailings all over the
place? Well, they were willing to give me any job I wanted.
I see.
For them on the shipbuilding plant that they had.
But you wanted to be independent.
I wouldn't go down. I looked it up on the map. It was a regular pest hole.
By you?
No. Not healthy there at all. It was on the riverbank there so much. And I'd already been in the Navy. I'd been holed up one time in the in a small river outside of Charleston, West, South Carolina, and I don't like those back creeks there or rivers there. They're very unhealthy.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So I wouldn't go with them. I wouldn't go with them.
Regardless of pain, and you said no.
Yeah, I wouldn't go with them. No.
No. So you.
But they said they'd give me any kind of a job. I don't know. They meant well. I'm sure they did, but there wasn't anything much I could do down there that I knew of.
So when you sent out these 100,000 mailings now about this grinding the bearings and stuff like that, how did you get a good response then?
Is that your
response?
Well, I paved the way for somebody coming there and demonstrated. See?
Demonstrate, I see.
And that was more or less, people will not buy too much from circulars.
They like to see how it works.
Exactly. And that's the reason I went in. I would go to one city. In the forenoon, I would go to the best service station, Cadillac, or at that time, Willis Overland and Nash were quite big and all that. Go to the best one, Cadillac mostly, and demonstrate it, see? And they say, seems to work beautifully. How much? I tell them, it was the jobber would buy it at 60 off, and they sold it at 40 off to the garages and service stations. And it was a list price of $1.50 for 2 ounces.
For 2 ounces.
The can cost more than what's in it, I can tell you that. It didn't cost much to make it. Powder that we got buying it, very, very cheap.
And there was no one but you that had this formula? You were the only one?
No, there was five of them.
Five of them?
Yeah, eventually. I don't say it was when I went into it, I don't say it was, no. But eventually it was five.
Oh.
But then one company got the patents on it. And that's how it broke up.
Well, you couldn't continue then?
No. They closed everybody up. So the one company had it.
I see. But they worked fine though?
Huh?
You could sell a lot of it?
As far as I know, they talked about the Fifth Avenue Bus Company in New York. They were going to set up a series of machines to grind them in, because they had a lot of bearing trouble on the Fifth Avenue buses. Fifth Avenue Bus Company was a big company. They had buses in every direction in New York City. An awful lot of work. I was in there quite a few times. Evidently, the ones that got out the patent, I don't know how they're doing. I really don't know.
What was it called now, this powder?
Huh?
What was it called? The name of it?
My particular?
Yeah.
100%. You said 100% bearing compound, that's all.
But that's all it was?
For 100% bearing, see.
Oh, I see.
I probably could have had a better name, but that's what I named
100%.
It.
100%. Uh-huh. So there was... So after that, you came back to Providence again then and settled
on? Well, when I went to, I took it from New York. I made it in the basement of some people that I knew that had a big basement. Said, you can use that, see. I will say that it sitted down an awful lot of stuff. They had a lot of cleaning to do afterwards. But they were friends that I made. When I got to Providence, my folks had a place out in the country. My father had retired from being a worker so much and bought into a farm. He wanted to live a different life in the country, see. And there I transferred over to an old hen house. And I had a father that worked for me in the business by that time. His name was Batson. And he had a son. He says, I'll go out there and I'll work. Because it was kind of grimy work.
You had to mix it and stuff it in the
bag? No. The popping of it, it had a pop like popcorn, see, to get this case of metal thing. You couldn't see it. Grains were so small like just powder, see, but nevertheless it has sharp edges. A lot of small things got a lot of things to... also, see.
Was it dry powder or was it
dry? Absolutely. Dry. But you put oil with it. See.
I see. And they made it like a paste then?
Yeah, exactly. You take the bearing, I say, and pour a little powder on there, and then a little oil, mix it up, and then close up and then grind it away. See. I could demonstrate it in minutes for that matter, see. And most of the time when I went to these stations, there's something we really need, see. And how much?
So you had to sell every time
and
you
I says, all I can do is to take an order and what wholesale do you want to put it through? And they say, well, we buy from so-and-so, wholesale, see. And then I have these orders, see. I had a big string like this here with icing glass in front of it, and then I had the different endorsements from Capital Cadillac in New York, and I had this War Department thing and all this thing, and I had really good stuff to show them. There was no trouble to sell it to the garage because they saw the demonstration, and the jobber saw the order, and that was all to it. How much? So much a gross.
So you had the sale every day then? I mean, you made sales every minute of the day. As soon as you had demonstrated, you had a sale made. You never failed then, in other words.
No, I got an order from the order department there, and I took them to the jobber in the afternoon. In the forenoon I would go to the garage, in the afternoon I go to the wholesaler. Most of them would say, so-and-so we buy from, see. Well, I would go for the best one anyway.
So how were you staying then, in hotels?
I stayed a lot in YMCAs. I was cutting expenses as much as I could, naturally. Because when I was on a train, in them days, they had these Pullmans, you know, see. And I go from cities, from Cincinnati to, well, it would be
Columbus and Cleveland or Youngstown.
Youngstown was big enough, I guess, to go to.
Pittsburgh.
There were big cities there, Cleveland and Cincinnati and
Toledo.
I'm trying to somewhere along the Mississippi River there.
Or Dayton.
Yeah, I went to all the big ones anyway. I didn't miss anything in any cities over 35,000-40,000. I went to. But as I say, I was really on the road continually, not back at all for 13 weeks, 12 or 13 weeks at a time. So I really worked in them days.
How did they pay you now? Did they pay you by month or did you get the
The orders went into to Mr. John Butler.
I see.
The one that, it's all a story in itself. To get him, it's a partner, he didn't know anything about it, and I wanted so much money, so much for myself for development, and so much to share in the profit, see. And it's not easy to get money either from that side either, see.
You had to work two times then, first to sell it and then to get your pay.
And anyway, but he was there, see. Well, it's a long story again. When I came back from my second trip, the agreement was from the beginning that he was to go out for at least a 6 week trip or something like that, 4 weeks maybe six in the long run, mostly in the east. We saved New York State, New Jersey, and possibly Maryland or something like that for close work, see, not close in, see. Well, a man could do it and almost get back if he wanted to his home, see. Maybe a couple of days on the road, something like that. But then, when I came back, I said, now, John Milton, it's your turn to go out. Am I supposed to go out? I said, you know the agreement when you came with me, that you would go out when I got back from my trip. I was supposed to be best man at a wedding. I can't curse my friend up. I promise I'll be the best man. And I'm going to be in a tennis tournament. He was a good tennis player. He was a college man, by the way. I quit school in the third grade, as you know, in sixth grade. So he says, I've got to keep this tennis thing. I got to keep there. I'm booked in there, and best man. I can't go. I says, okay. So we both sat there for about 3 or 4 months and shipped out what orders came in, repeat orders shipped out. And I wouldn't go out again because I was really tired, and I had it rolling enough so some repeat orders came, see. And this was New York, mind you, see. But then, as I said, I went to Rhode Island to where my people were, and then we continued making it. But if you don't keep after things with competition, forget about it, because
they will take over.
In the long run, somebody will take it.
Yeah. You gotta be at it.
Take the business. You have to be at it.
So, what kind of feeling did you get for companionship now? Were you afraid to have a partner in the next venture then?
You mean when
you started with this now here in Providence? Were you try to do it alone then instead of having a partner? You get tired of partnership, I suppose.
Well, we dissolved that.
We dissolved it, yeah.
Because I kept the problems for one thing, see.
Yeah.
But
then when you started up here in Providence,
yeah,
you didn't ask for any partners then anymore. You were tired of partnership.
No. The business was peeling out because competition. Understand, there was five others making it, see. And I don't know, they could have made it just as good as mine was. Huh.
So they was tough to...
So a good thing when you got it, forget it afterwards, see, because I was tired, very tired of being on the road. Oh. And I was happy to be home.
Yeah. So, then you started here in...
The finish of you, like, no what?
Yeah, no, oh, yes.
All right. Sure. Father came around and says, he said, I have a son, he says, I want to put in business. I know that you're making this bearing compound, and I'd like to have him take over. He's a good boy, and he can make something of it, and I know you got a good groundwork on it, so that...